Absolutely.
It might have been mentioned already, not directly related to our shir, but today, of course, Tainis Esther. It's not in the regular time that we normally fast, but in any case, the Tainis Esther that we normally fast right before Purim is not really on time anyway, because Esther's fast, as we'll see in the shir, really took place on Pesach. It's a special day for tefillah, as many Sfarim point out that much of the Yeshua, the salvation of Purim, came about as a result of Esther's tefillos. So it's a very opportune time to ask of HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that which we need and that which Klal Yisrael needs. And it's brought down in the Sfarim that especially Mizmor Chof Bet, which is traditionally the Mizmor that Esther recited as she was about to enter to Ahasuerus's inner chambers to plead her case before him. The mizmor that begins Keili Lama Saftani, where she calls out to God because she felt somewhat that Hashem was leaving her, but then of course Yeshua came. And on Purim as well, the Sfarim bring down that that's also an appropriate mizmor to say, but as always, all Tehillim is good, all personal requests are good, and the Ikar is to seize the moment. Okay, we wanted to give a shir on the Megillah. And of course, any shir on the Megillah, of course, in a broader way, speaks about Purim as well. The title of the shir, Hidden and Revealed, which of course can mean anything in the world you want it to mean, but it has a specific meaning, which is, and just to start with the words of Rav Chaim Friedlander, one of the great Balei HaMachshava of this past century, Zichrono Livracha, in a sefer many of you may be familiar with, called, I think it's Sichas Chaim, if I'm not mistaken. So he writes that the Megillah, in a certain sense, has three names to it. Klal Yisrael have crowned it with the name Megillah. That's also the name that's used in the Gemara Megillah. There's even a Yiddish expression, as you're all familiar with, that against the Megillah means like a whole story, sometimes a story that seemingly unnecessary. It's also called Esther. That's, if you will, its official title in the order of Tanakh. And it's also, in the Megillah itself, referred to not as a Megillah, but as an Igeris, as a letter. And it's very interesting that, on the one hand, it's written like a scroll is, a Megillah. It's stored, if you will, in a rolled-up fashion, Megillah from the language of Ligolel. But since it's called a letter, so therefore, there are several halachot, some of them widely practiced, some not so widely practiced, and minhagim, if you will, that relate to the fact that it's called a letter. One of them is that at least bitzibur, when we're reading it in public, so as the Gemara indicates, poshta ki igeris, you spread it out like a letter, which is why, when you attend a public Megillah reading, so before they start, you see all this rustling on the bima, where they're spreading out the scroll. Usually, you have to bend it over a little bit. It's not so easy to take a scroll and open it that way. Poshta ki geris, just like a letter. First, you open the letter, you read it. You don't read a letter slowly by scrolling slowly. So that's one halacha that is widely practiced. There's another, I think, more as a minhag that's brought down by the Torah. That if it was, let's say, a formal Torah reading, so we would read it slowly. But the fact that it's called Igeres, so it's minhag to read it somewhat more quickly. I remember that was one of the things Rabbi Cohen, we quoted him before in a previous year from Mishin University. So he once said to the Baal Kore, wonderful job! His name was Rabbi Menachem Jacobowitz, maybe some of you know him. He's a dying here in Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Menachem Jacobowitz, so he was a wonderful Bakor, he got everything right, and a lot of emphasis, he would put in the voices of Haman and Mordechai, all kinds of things. So Rabbi Cohen says, absolutely fantastic, said one thing, you went too slow, it's supposed to be an Igeris. And that's interesting, because Rabbi Cohen does everything slow. But it says in the Torah, you're supposed to read it fast, so you got to read this quickly. So it's called an Igeris. So Rabbi Friedlander has a fascinating insight on a Remez level that these three names are really indicative of a very important, we'll call it an art theme throughout the whole Megillah. On the one hand, it's Esther. And Esther, as we know from the words of Chazal, is reminiscent of the word haster astir. It has a certain sense of hiddenness to it. On the other hand, it's called Megillah. And even on a simple level, Megillah is derived from the word legolel, to roll, but it also has the same root as legalot, to reveal. So Megillas Esther, the name, tells it all. That on the one hand, it's very hidden, as we'll elaborate. On the other hand, it comes to reveal that which is hidden. And then finally, the word Igeres, if I'm not mistaken, I'm not even sure if you find that word Igeres in the rest of Tanakh. You have to check me on this, in the Concordancia. But the Megillah actually has a few Aramaic words in there, because that's what many spoke then. So he suggests that that word Igeres, besides the simple meaning that it means a letter, but it also comes from the Shoresh Oger. Oger means to gather. And here, this is a point that we want to focus on a bit, that in order to get the true meaning of Esther, so we have to both reveal the hidden, but we also have to take it as a conglomerate, as something, as a package. We can't take each piece in and of itself. In order to appreciate what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for us and the great salvation that occurred, we have to view it as an agira, as an ogeris, to gather it all together. And he suggests that perhaps that's the reason that we spread it all out. Because the point is that if you want to appreciate what Megillas Esther is, you can't just read it little by little. Maybe that's also the reason you have to read it quickly. Because in order to get the picture, you have to see everything together. And that's what many of the commentaries, their overarching theme, if you will, in explaining the Megillah is exactly that. For example, one of the great Gedol Yisrael, his name was Rav Yaakov Loberbaum from the early 19th century. In the yeshivas, he's known as the Baal HaNesivos. He wrote a very famous commentary on Chol Shem Mishpat, which is studied very, very assiduously. So he wrote a commentary, I think, on all five Megillot. So his commentary on Esther, he called the Megillat Starim, which of course means literally the scroll of hiddenness. And he writes in the introduction that my point is to show you all of the miracles that you might miss if you just read the Megillah on a surface level. If we back up a little bit, we could understand, not only as you've all heard, the idea of a hidden miracle, Nes Nistar, that the Megillah represents, and as opposed to, let's say, the holiday of Pesach, where the miracles were Nisim Niglim, they were revealed miracles. But the Megillas Esther represents hidden miracles. In other words, miracles that unless you contemplate and unless you think, you will miss them. You'll think that they're just lucky breaks or chance circumstances. And indeed, the famous idea that many Sfarim quote, that the Shem Hashem does not appear in the Megillah, to highlight the fact that without contemplating what happened, you wouldn't really think it was HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But on a different plane, the Ibn Ezra, on a pshat level, if you will, explains why the Shem Hashem does not appear. And he writes, as becomes clear from the Megillah, it's called Divrei HaIgeres HaZos, that Mordechai and Esther were sending out this letter to all of Klal Yisrael. This was an open letter, if you will, describing the history. And Achashverosh was still alive. And Achashverosh's officers, of course, were also there. And if this letter would in any way describe what really happened with all of its details, then that might make Achashverosh look bad. And of course, he would not allow such a letter to be publicized. And even worse, he might take it out on Esther, and she might have been the second Vashti, as well as Klal Yisrael. So the Ibn Ezra writes that the Shem Hashem does not appear because had it appeared, then the translations of the Megillah, which probably would have been made, Ibn Ezra reasons, to be put into the official archives of the king, the Divrei Hayomim Asher Lamalchei Madaya Paras, that name of God, the Shem HaKadosh, of the one and only, would have been translated as some Persian deity. And that would have been a terrible disgrace to substitute the name of the Melech Malchei Melochim to the name of some worthless idol. So therefore, the Mordechai and Esther left the name out in order that the name of Hashem should not be disgraced in that way. But of course, those two interpretations can be put together. The interpretation of the Shem Hashem being omitted because of the fear of it being disgraced, and the fact that the Shem Hashem is omitted because it was a Nes Nistar, it highlights the idea that as we read through the Megillah, we have to read through between the lines, not only in order to appreciate the miracle, but it was written in a way that makes us have to read through between the lines, because the whole story is not being told here out of fear of, repercussions had the full story been told. And of course that helps explain why Chazal have two interpretations of Achashverosh, Gemara Megillah, whether he was a Melech Tipesh or whether he was a Melech Rasha. Was he just a fool, easily swayed by the power of the moment? If he's drunk, so he kills his wife. In another moment of fiery passion, so he killed Haman, the one who originally had him kill his wife. Everything he's doing on a whim. Is that really what Achashverosh is? Or is it somewhat more diabolical, if you will, where Achashverosh is a full partner with Haman in the eradication of the Jews? And it was only through some great miracle that Hashem changed his heart, if you will, to kill Haman and give Mordechai and Esther permission to, at least through the back door, to override the decree of Haman. How so, says the Medrash? The Medrash comments that the Gemara in Megillah, that Haman and Achashverosh, when Haman presents the Aseret Alafim Kikar Kesef, the 10,000 gold coins, silver coins, as a bribe, if you will, to Achashverosh for allowing him to execute this mysterious nation, which on a simple level on the Megillah, you could say that Achashverosh didn't even know that it was the Jews, perhaps following that opinion of Melech Tipeshaya, that he was a fool. But according to this other Midrashic idea, no, he knew fully well who Haman was referring to, and perhaps Haman even spelled it out. Why then wouldn't the Megillah actually write that? Because you can't make Achashverosh look bad. You can't make Achashverosh look as if he intended to kill all the Jews. So therefore Mordechai and Esther would have to edit out that line and say that Haman just asked for the eradication of some mysterious nation that was causing trouble to the king. Says the Gemara that it's a mashal to two neighbors. One has a pit and one has a mound. And the one who has a pit in his yard, then he keeps falling into it and other things keep falling into it, is complaining. And the one with the mound also, he keeps bumping into it, he can't walk smoothly, so he wants to get rid of that. And suddenly, the light bulb goes on. Wait a second. Sounds like Sesame Street. Wait a second. Let's take the pit and fill it in with the dirt. And this way, your ground will be smooth, my ground will be smooth. So too, when Haman comes to Achashverosh and offers the 10,000 silver coins, so Achashverosh tells Haman, HaKesef Nesunlach, forget about the money. Ve'ha'am la'sos bo kirtzonecha. Do whatever you want with the nation. In other words, I want to get rid of the Jews too. And you want to get rid of them as well? You mean I don't even have to hire troops for this? I don't have to expend government money for this? Great! You'll be my agent in killing the Jews. And this way we'll all be naki from this from these pesky people who are the guilty conscience of the world. The Sifsei Chaim, actually. This is our Friedlander Sefer we have here. I didn't get a chance to see it inside, but apparently it must be on the Mo'adim. I got it from this beautiful Sefer. I always like to give advertisements for Sforim. This is called the Tale Oros. Besides some ideas that I've heard through the years, I gathered a few more juicy ideas on the way here. The very popular series on Chumash, on the Mo'adim, on Megillas Esther. He collects from all over the place. A knockout sefer. What a beautiful sefer, the Tale Oros. So in any case, what we see here again is one installment of this idea of the hidden and the revealed. Achashverosh is also not so, he's a partner in crime of Haman, but yet the Megillah covers it up a bit in order to, again, preserve the, if you will, the sub-story within the revealed story. It's popularly stated that the Shem Hashem does not appear in the Megillah, but of course that's not quite true. As I'm sure many of you are aware, There are rimazim, and one would expect Esther had Ruach HaKodesh, Mordechai was a member of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. One would expect they somehow would be able to, again, under the radar screen, sneak in the name of Hashem. And what I did on this particular handout that I gave out to you is I wrote down, through bolding the letters, all of the rimazim for the name of Hashem that I brought down in various Sfarim. It was already noted in the days of the Rishonim. The earliest source that I found it in was Rabbeinu Bechaye, a student of the Rashba, who in turn was a student of the Ramban. So he notes that the name of Hashem is alluded to in the Megillah. Just wanted to share with you the two most famous ones, and we'll just touch upon the other ones that I added on this year. If you look at Perek Hay, it's on the second side. So we have Esther is in her careful plot here to bring about the downfall of Haman. So she invites the king and Haman to the meal. And those words are Yavo HaMelech veHaman Hayom, that let the king and Haman come. And of course, as you see, as we bolded it, that spells out the Rashi Tevot, Yudke Vovke. I'm not sure who the originator of the idea that any time, if I'm not, it could already be the Gemara Megillah, I just forget. Any time in the Megillah the word Melech is listed, that has a dual meaning. And again, that touches upon, again, the hidden and revealed within the Megillah. If it's the Melech HaChashverosh, but it's also the Melech Malchei Amlochim. And here it fits very beautifully where there's a revealed statement of Esther, let the king, parentheses, Achashverosh, and Haman come today. But on a deeper level, she's davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. May you bless my efforts with success. Can you please join me in this meal to bring down this arch enemy of Klal Yisrael and you HaKadosh Baruch Hu yourself. Yavo HaMelech V'Haman Hayom. There's even a minhag that most Megillot that are written nowadays, they're called HaMelech Megillot. Every column, except for the first one, Vayihi, that's not Melech, but every beginning of the column begins with the word HaMelech. There's no actual halacha to write it that way. There's an old minig, at least several hundred years old, they call it a HaMelech Megillah, in order to highlight that idea, because there's a dual meaning to HaMelech. Melech HaChashverosh and the Melech Malchim Lochim. If you take a look in that same parak in Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'chol zeh einenu shoveli, V'chol eis asher ani roes Mordechai HaYehudi. This is Haman speaking, and he's saying that none of this is worth anything, even though Haman is describing his great wealth and his great pomp and circumstance and the fact that he was the only one who was invited to the intimate feast just with the king and Esther the queen. Of course, at this point, he doesn't realize that this is Esther the Jewess. So he says, none of this is worth anything as long as Mordechai Yehudi is around. And of course, he hatches the plot based on the advice of his lovely wife, Zeresh, to make a tree 50 amos high and hang Mordechai on it. What is the V'chol Zeh Einenu Shovali? Once again, a remez. If we see it's the Shem Hashem in the Sofei Tevot and written backwards. Right? Yud Kei Vav Kei. Or Kei Vav Kei Yud. What perhaps is the remez there? So we know that Haman is Agagi. Right? He is a descendant of King Agag, the king of Amalek that Shaul had spared. And he's warring against the Jews, following in the footsteps of his notorious ancestor, Amalek, who was the first one to war against the Jews after they left Mitzrayim. And as Chazal tell us, a very important theme for Parashat Zohar that we'll be reading this week, there's a dual milchama against Amalek. It's Klal Yisrael's job to war against Amalek, but the Ribbono Shel Olam says in Parshas B'Shalach, Milchama Hashem B'Amalek, Midor Dor. There's a war of God against Amalek. Why? Because Amalek's attack against the Jewish people is not really an attack on a nation. It's an attack on the Ribbono Shel Olam, whose message this nation tries to carry to the world. That's the term I used earlier, that the Jews serve as the guilty conscience of the world. If you erase the Jews from the world scene, then there's no voice that tells us, be holy. There's no voice that tells us, be special. There's no voice that tells us, become a true Tzelem Elokim. So what does Haman say? V'chol zeh inenu shaveli. This is worthless. This Yudke Vavke, the Rabbanu Shalom, it's worthless, it's meaningless. We'll battle against him and we will be victorious. Another allusion to the Shem Hashem by telling us that Haman himself is really battling against the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then finally, in Perek Zayin, where the king gets up in his rage because Hester just revealed that Haman wanted to kill the nation of his beloved queen. So, V'amelech kam b'chamaso, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Zayin, Mishtei Ayayin al Ginata Bisan, V'haman amad, L'vakesh al nafsho, typo there, May Esther Amalka, Ki ra'a, Ki cholesa elav ha-ra'a, May Eis HaMelech. Because he's doomed. That's it. His days are numbered. Once again, the Sofei Tevot, Ki cholesa elav ha-ra'a, Yud Kei Vav Kei, May Eis HaMelech. The Melech Malchi Amlochim. He is not going to be victorious, not over the Jewish nation that represents the Kadosh Baruch Hu in the world, and certainly not over the Ribbono Shalom himself. Me'eis HaMelech, again a dual meaning, the Melech Achashverosh, but also the Melech Malchi Amlochim. There are other Rimazim, and I urge you to think, I haven't on my own really to think about. If you look on page 1, there are other Yudke Vavkes there, perhaps to contemplate why they're there. Some of them are actually out of order. Kabbalistically, they are permutations of the name of Hashem, and they all have meaning. So Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, Yud-Kei Kei Vav, and so on and so forth. Some of the names here are actually spelled not forwards, not backwards, but with the letters somewhat out of order. For the mathematical minded among you, so there are 12 permutations of the name of Hashem. 4 times 3 times 2 divided by 2, because they're two hays. Okay. Let's continue with our hidden analysis, if you will, trying to reveal some of the great miracles of the Megillah. Many of you have heard, I'm sure all of you have, the idea of the Kelim Mikelim Shonim. I underlined in Perek Aleph Halacha Zayin. Seemingly redundant pasuk. Kelim Mikelim Shonim. Just say, Kelim Harbei, Kelim Shonim. What's Kelim Miko Kelim Shonim? So, anybody remember what the Midrash says about this? The Baal Kori actually reads this in the Nigun of Eicha. V'chelim, Kelim Shonim. What's unique about these vessels? Go ahead.
From the Beit HaMikdash.
So in other words, as the Gemara Megillah spells out for us, Achashverosh's feast is not just a feast of solidifying his kingdom and showing his great wealth to his subjects. But what else is it if he's taking the Kelim out from the Beit HaMikdash? What is he celebrating? The victory over the Jews. It's like, you know, that great arch in Italy, Judea Capta, right? We won against the Jews. Now, why is that so significant? The Jews are not the most populous nation. They're not the most rebellious of nations. Why is it so unbelievable to be victorious over the Jews? Goes back to that again. If we could be victorious over the Jews, we wipe out the guilty conscience of the world, and we can do whatever we want. There's no need for Kedusha. There's no need to follow HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So victory against the Jews, somehow, throughout history. And, of course, in the papers, you might see that the European Union is against Medinas Yisrael because it's apartheid and they're persecuting the Arabs. Or you might see in a different analysis that the United States feels it has to somewhat be appeasing to the Arab nations, because otherwise, you know, it'll bring about the world war, or the price of oil will go up. But our Chachamim teach us there's always a hidden behind the revealed. The war is still not over. The nations of the world, till Bias HaMashiach, will always eternally be at war. Sometimes openly, sometimes privately. To Chalila, eradicate, or at least in some way harm, the Jewish people. As the brother Martin Luther King Jr. said, when they tell you anti-Israel, they don't mean anti-Israel, they mean anti-Jew. Except it's no longer politically correct to say anti-Jew. So people hide behind anti-Israel. Anyway, this is not our forum for now, but that's also a very major theme in the Megillah. The war against Klal Yisrael is always the war against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'chelim mikelim shonim. Achashverosh takes out the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. Victory over the Jews. Judea capta. They'll never come back. And if the Beis HaMikdash will never be rebuilt, so then my Malchus will be able to be eternally established. Because if the Jews are up, then eventually I'm going to have to go down. Many of you have probably heard of the famous year count. Why did Achashverosh pick this particular time in order to make this feast? So the Gemara Megillah tells us that there was a prophecy that all the nations knew from Yirmi Hanovi that there were going to be 70 years from the something to do with Bavel, Le Bavel, and then the Jews will be remembered. The exile will be over. And if the exile's over, that means that the nations that would have been subduing the Jews are going to fall. So everyone's counting. When are those 70 years up? Right? You have all these websites now. Kaduri.net. When's the Mashiach coming? Mashiach.net. Everyone is trying to calculate. When is the Messiah coming? Everyone's going crazy about the millennium. You know, that's not from our religion, but in 2000, everyone, the world is fixated on when the Messiah is going to come, when the Geula is going to come. In this specific instance, if the Geula doesn't come when it's supposed to come, so then the nations of the world are going to make a party, because that means the Jews are down and we'll be able to be in our seats forever. So what's the count? So the first one who made a mistake about this was, of course, anybody learned this before? Could be that he's also called that. And they not only refer to him as Baal Sheitzar. You say Sheishbatzar? Baal Sheitzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. The son of Nebuchadnezzar makes a calculation that it's from the beginning, a grandson actually, from the beginning of his grandfather's reign. So 70 years from the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign ended in Baal Sheitzar's second year. What does he do? He also makes a party. What happens at the party?
Writing
on the wall, right? That famous expression, the writing on the wall, a hand comes down from heaven, writes on the wall, Menei, Menei, Kelo Farsin, which meant your days are numbered. The Persians are going to take over. They didn't know what it said. They got Daniel to interpret it, and as soon as Daniel interpreted it, he went into some kind of shock, and that night, Darius the Mede overran the Babylonian Empire, took over. So he was wrong. Where did he go wrong? Because the 70 years weren't from the beginning of the kingdom of Bavel. They were some other calculation. What was the calculation? So Achashverosh reasons, well, the Jews were exiled twice. The final Jewish settlement there, Yehuda, the Malchut Yehuda. One was 11 years before. We could see that in the Megillah, a reference to that in Perek Bet, where it says, in Pasuk Hey, Ish Yehudi Ayavishan Abira, etc. Asher Hagla Mirushalayim, Im Hagola Asher Haglata, Im Yechanya Melech Yehuda, Asher Hagla Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. Which exile was this? The exile of Yechanya, who is also known as Yehoyachin. He was exiled 11 years before the final exile, where the rest of Klal Yisrael were taken. So, 11 years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, there was a mini-exile. And Achashverosh's 70 years ended right then. So he made a party. They're not going back. And of course he was wrong too. But the Beit HaMikdash was built exactly 11 years later. Not by Achashverosh, but by the son of Achashverosh and Esther, Dayavesh Darius II, who gave permission to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And then they finally did. So, I wanted to analyze this a little bit. Was everyone really wrong? Were they really wrong about the count? So, last semester we spoke a lot about the Bias HaMashiach and the Emos HaMashiach. And one of the things we focused on is the concept of Kates. That there's a set date for the Geula to occur. But we also learned that the concept of Kates is a very, very slippery one, because the Geula could really occur at any other time. So what's that called, that other concept, the idea of the Geula occurring at any point in time? Achishena. Achishena, the fact that I will rush it. The fact that if Klal Yisrael act properly, or sometimes other divine calculations, the Geula could occur at any time. What emerges then is that the kitsim, if you will, the end times that are set, are somewhat shrouded in mystery, because really HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't create himself as bound by that. But what we have, though, is that sometimes there are various dates for the redemption, and each of those dates, in the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings it about, serve as a significant point in time in the redemptive process. One idea that's developed is something that the Gra developed at length, the Ramchal, is that there's a difference between Pekida and Zechira. Pekida, if you will, a remembrance, a mini remembrance, and Zechira, a massive remembrance. What's the difference? Pekida represents the beginning of the process of redemption. Sometimes the term Aschalt the Geula, which has become very popular in the last few decades, is used for that. Pekida, that Hashem, Pakod Pakadati. Where was that said? Well, I'm sorry, what was that? Oh, it is said about Sarah as well, Pakad Sarah. But the term Pakod Pakadati is in Yetzias Mitzrayim. But when did it happen? The Geula didn't happen yet. That's when Moshe Rabbeinu was informed, Pakod Pakadati, and he sent that message to Klal Yisrael. But it took a while till the redemption actually occurred, because that wasn't the Zechira yet, it was only the Pekida. So, was Baal Shem Tov wrong? That the 70 years from the beginning of the period of the Babylonian kingdom, was he totally wrong? In a certain sense, he was right. Because soon after that, what happened? There was a Pekida. Right? After all the dust cleared from Darius killing Nebuchadnezzar, Baal Shem Tov, and someone killing Darius, who was the next one in line? Koresh. And what did Koresh do, the famous Koresh? He let Klal Yisrael go back to Eretz Yisrael. Ko Amar Hashem, right? L'mashicha l'Koresh is identified by name hundreds of years earlier by Yeshaya. And then Koresh, taking that calling, says, Hashem has appointed me to give permission to the Jews to go back. And originally they thought they would build the Beis HaMikdash right away. Didn't work out. Koresh removed the permission. And then it was only much later that the permission was re-granted by, as we said, Ahasuerus and Esther's son. The date, 70 years, that Baal Shem Tov thought was correct, it was correct in a certain plane. But it wasn't going to be the Beis HaMikdash rebuilding, but it was going to be Klal Yisrael being remembered, Pekida, to come back to Eretz Yisrael. What about Ahasuerus's count? Was that in any way meaningful? Or was he also just dead wrong? So perhaps we can suggest, we're just thinking about this, this is my own pshat. The first pshat that we gave is from the Gra, that in the days of Koresh there was a Pekida. Baal Shem Tov was not totally wrong. But the idea that Ahasuerus also was, so just going in that direction, perhaps we could say the following. What happened net after the whole Megillah is over? What did Klal Yisrael do as a result? So let's take a look at a very famous pasuk that is recorded by the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Pei Chesem and Aleph. You have this in Perek Tes. See if you could find this. Pasuk Chav Zayin. Kiyemu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim aleihem v'al zaram v'al kol ha-nilvim aleihem. The Jews fulfilled and they accepted upon themselves, on them and on all their children and all those who had joined them, a reference to Geri Tzedek, to celebrate the Shnei Ayim HaEle, on a simple level, what are they being mekayim? What are they being mekabel? What are they fulfilling? What are they accepting? Purim. But on a deeper level, Chazal say it wasn't just accepting Purim. It was re-accepting Torah. My Rebbe, Rav Shechter, who just addressed you a little while ago, so he always gave over to us on around Purim time the idea that Purim is like Shavuos. It's a day of Matan Torah. It's a day of Matan Torah. He even quoted, the Gemara tells us that there's a somewhat of a debate how to celebrate Yom Tov. Do you have to have massive meals on Yom Tov? Is it enough just to have a little bit of eating, but the rest of the day should be just learning and davening? But everyone agrees that on Shavuos you have to have massive meals because it's the day of Matan Torah, so you have to be very festive. And the day of Purim, also you have to have a massive meal. As it says, Yemei Mishtev Simcha, the days of festivity. But there's one version of that Gemara, it's quoted by the Gaonim, because it's Yom Shenitna Bo Torah, or Yom Shekiblu Bo Torah. It's another Shavuos. So what's happening here? Klal Yisrael, as a result of this decree, they get the message, and they realize that Ein Manos, we can't run away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we can't assimilate into the Persians, which was one of the sins that led to this decree, that when they joined the festive meal of Achashverosh, they were giving up their identity, if you will, as Jews, and then they realized, Ein Manos, there's no way to run away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they ran right back into his arms. Kimu v'kiblu Ayhudim, they re-accepted the Torah. And what emerges from this re-acceptance of the Torah? So just a few years later, the Beis HaMikdash is built. Was Achashverosh wrong? Totally? Maybe not. Maybe, I don't know, from a different plane, this unleashed a whole slew of events that led to Kabbalah HaTorah, which ultimately gave the schus for Klal Yisrael to finally have the Beis HaMikdash be rebuilt. And of course, that's what we see, as many of the Sfarim point out, the Maharal and many others, Geula is a repeating process. The first Geula was in Mitzrayim. What follows the physical redemption? The spiritual redemption? Matan Torah. What happens after Matan Torah? Originally it was supposed to be right away, but we blew it a little bit, so it took 40 years. Then you enter into Eretz Yisrael. Then you build Mikdash. But even before that happened, what was the mini Mikdash that was built right after Matan Torah? The Mishkan. Kabbalah HaTorah followed by Geula. So perhaps we could suggest, again, marching in the way of the Vilna Gaon, that the original count of Belshazzar wasn't really wrong. So maybe the count of Achashverosh also wasn't wrong, because this ushered in a very important event in Klal Yisrael's history for them to merit a second Beit HaMikdash. Of course, much could be said in terms of contemporary times, applying these concepts of Pekida and Kabbalah HaTorah and Zechira, but it's not our forum here, but with a little bit of imagination, and I'm sure many of you have studied this as well, one can easily see an enormous Yad Hashem in this regard as well. Let's continue our journey through the hidden and the revealed in the Megillah. Vashti, of course, is bumped off at the beginning of the Megillah. And on a simple plane, that is what clears the plate, if you will, for Esther to step up and ultimately serve as a source of salvation, as an agent of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to bring about salvation to the Jewish people. There's a sefer that I never heard about. That's one of the good aspects of this sefer, Tali Oros, that it collects from all over the place, including not such populous for him. It was written by Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi. Who is Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, you might ask? I have no idea. But he wrote a sefer called Yosef Lekach on the Megillah. And judging by that which he quotes from this sefer, seems to be a very, very wonderful sefer. And he points out, getting back to what we discussed earlier, about the fact that you have to take the whole picture of the Megillah in order to appreciate what's going on. One of the, if you will, excuses that can be given, or events, if you will, that would de-miraculize, if we could invent that phrase, the various events that occurred, is that, well, what happened in the end? Achashverosh loves his wife Esther, right? As the Megillah speaks about, v'tim sachein v'chesed lefanav, which parenthetically is one of the other miracles. Chazal had a tradition that Esther wasn't so beautiful. She was Yirak Rokes. She didn't have such a pretty complexion. But nonetheless, Hashem placed chein in the eyes of Achashverosh. I don't know, there's a funny children's book on the Megillah, and they have depict Esther as green because of that midrash. Esther's always green, and I think they got a little bit too extreme. But okay, you'll have to analyze this to how literally you should give over midrashim to your children. Anyway, your acrocus probably means yellow in that context, so probably not green. Okay, be that as it may, we know that either because of her beauty on a pshat level, or because of some divine miracle, on Achashverosh is in love with his wife. So when he finds out that Haman wants to kill the nation of his own wife, so of course he gets into a rage, and of course he kills the perpetrator, and of course he gives permission to his wife to stand up for their rights. Mikra! Lucky break! So here again, you got to read the whole story. Does Achashverosh play favorites with the wives that he loves? He loved Vashti too. But yet, on a whim, he kills her. So you see that Achashverosh does not allow his emotions about his emotional connection to his spouse to necessarily listen to what they're going to what they're saying and to override decrees that he himself is a partner in writing. Again, a bigger picture increasing the miracle, demonstrating all these contradictions. Chazal put it very beautifully. Biglal ohavo horag ishto. Uviglal ishto horag ohavo. Right? Because of the one who was close to him originally, Mimuchan, right? He takes his advice, kills his wife. And because of his wife, he kills his former friend. What's happening here? It's too weird to be just lucky break. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is playing tricks with these pawns here, and he's using them to bring about this greatness. I want to jump a little bit. I'm sure many of you have heard this, but for the benefit of those who perhaps haven't, let's just take a look at the hanging of the sons of Haman. Perek Tes is actually the killing of the sons of Haman, who are later hanged. Perek Tes, Pasuk Zayin. It's a little bit of a Balkori's nightmare, because they're supposed to be read in one breath. Because there's the tradition that they all died at the exact same time. Ve'ez Parshan, we're not going to read it in one breath. Ve'ez Parshan Dasa, Ve'ez Dalfon. I don't know, somehow the Pays kept becoming Tzadis over here. I'm not sure what's going on with this... Okay, Veis Parashandasa, Veis Dalfon, etc. Aspasa, all the way down to Vayezasa. So many of you have probably heard that one of the great Hasidic Rebbes, I wish I could remember who it was, I just read it relatively recently, but I forgot, noted that for years and years, it wasn't clear why some letters are big and some letters are small. Parashandasa, the tough is small. But for word, I'm able to play around with the fonts. In Pasuk Tes, Parmashta, the shin is small. And again, Vayezasa, the Zion is small. Tov shin Zion. And the Vav is big. In the Masara, we know there are such letters in the Chumash as well. To a lesser extent throughout Tanakh. It's called a Vav Rabati, a big Vav. Or a shin ze'era, a small shin. But what is the remez here? I think some of the Rishonim deal with it, but they don't seem to give such satisfactory answers. So one of the Chassidish Rebbes, sometime after the Holocaust, said, I think I figured out the remez. Because as we said, Amalek, till the Bias HaMashiach, is a recurring phenomenon. And as Rabbi Soloveitchik very famously quoted from his grandfather, Reb Chaim, based on a certain Rambam, just to give it over quickly, the Rambam writes that the mitzvah to eradicate the seven nations, the Canaanim, no longer applies. Because all the Canaanim and the Amorim are all mixed up as a result of Sanhedrin's massive population movements. Right, that was a very popular method back then to make sure people wouldn't rebel against you. So you take the indigenous populace and ship them out, and you take others and ship them in. So there are no more Canaanim, Amorim, and so on and so forth. But yet the Rambam writes that there's still a mitzvah to eradicate Amalek. Why don't you say the same thing? That we don't really have Amalekites anymore because they're all mixed up? So Reb Chaim Soloveitchik very famously stated that any nation that takes upon itself the goal of destroying the Jewish people has a halacha of Amalek, even if they're not biologically, genetically related. That's why Rabbi Soloveitchik, somewhat in a controversial manner, ruled that the state of Israel was not allowed to benefit from reparations given by the German government, because you're not allowed to benefit from the assets of Amalek. As Chazal say, that's why, even though Haman gave a decree based on Achashverosh's consent to destroy the Jewish people, Ushlalam Lavos, and to take away the spoils, but if you look in the Megillah, when the Jews are warring against their enemies, V'nafochu, so what does it say there in Perek? Should be there. I thought it said it. Somewhere it's supposed to say that they did not put their hands in the spoil. There it is. In Pasuk Tes Zayin, Perek Tes. Right? Ashara Yehudim Asher Yenos HaMelech Nikalu V'Moral Nafsham. Again, these Saudis keep creeping up. Noach Moav Vehem Varog Besoniem Chamisha V'Shivim Alef Uvabiza Lo Shalchu Es Yadam. They don't take the spoils. Why not? I guess on a simple plane you could say they weren't interested in money. Now they were just interested in saving their lives. But on a deeper plane, Chazal say because it was Amalek's assets, you can't benefit from Amalek's assets. So that's why the Rav, in a controversial way, said that the state of Israel was not and is not allowed to take reparations from them. It's din of Amalek. Because the German people just waged war against the Jewish people. Then apparently in later years, Rabbi Soloveitchik, my Rebbe, Rabbi Schechter, wrote up, so he thought maybe his psak was wrong, because he felt that the Jewish state was able to blossom as a result of all these reparations. So the Rabbon Hashem wouldn't have allowed that to happen if it was also to do that. So he rethought that maybe this psak was incorrect. But be that as it may, the main idea of that, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, and of course the terrible, terrible leader who led them into this war against the Jews, had a din of Amalek. So this Hasidic Rebbe suggested that Esther and Mordechai were well aware of the fact that there was going to be another round. If you think about it, there were only two times in history, it's very hard to say this, two times in history that there was a decree to eradicate all of the Jewish people. One was done by Haman, and as we know from the Megillah, Revach v'atzala yamel ha'yehudim. Not a single Jew was killed. But as another Chassidish Rebbe wrote, I don't know how they know these things, that this decree was not eliminated. It was delayed. Ay, terrible idea to just contemplate. And that the second installment of this great decree came about in our relative recent history, with a different Haman, who decreed La Hashmid V'Lahar G'Lavei Kol Yehudim, and of course, his decree was also foiled, but not before it took with it 6 million. So this Chassidish Rebbe trying to see that with all this disaster that was brought about by this terrible modern-day Haman, but it was HaKadosh Baruch Hu who brought about the Yeshua. And if you read a little bit about the history of World War II, you could see that as well. But you have to have Esther's eyes to realize that the whole war itself, and certainly the end of the war, was a series of divine machinations to bring it about and to ultimately bring a stop to this decree. Even though, again, the Davonenu, it brought about to such disaster. So here, Mordechai and Esther put an allusion to this idea. What happened in Tov Shin Zion? 1947. Actually, I'm mistaken. 1946, after Rosh Hashanah. That's Tov Shin Zion. It was November. There's an article that they have floating around the internet. It was in Newsweek that records the date in November. What's the big Vav? The big Vav is a reference to the sixth millennium. That's, of course, 5,000 plus. So we have the year Tov Shin Zion, 5,707. Okay. 5,000, everybody knows Tashach. That's 5,708. That's the year of Akamas HaMedina, 1948. So this is Tov Shin Zion, a year and a bit before. And what happened on that fateful day in November, Tov Shin Zion? 12 Nazi officers who were heavily involved in killing the Jewish people were sentenced to execution by the trials that took place in the aftermath of the war, the international tribunals. One, the death sentence was commuted to life in prison, and one committed suicide in jail. And then there were 10 who were taken out to hang, and very curiously, and without explanation, as the noose was put on one of these great Rishoyim, they record his name in the papers, he screamed out, "Purim Fest! 1946. And no one really knew what he was talking about. I guess, you know, the Jews probably figured out, he feels that, you know, something like we're being destroyed again. Said this Chassidus Sherebbe, I would be indebted if someone could track down who it was. This is the Remez. Hiding for thousands of years. Wow, almost a 2,000 year old Remez. What a powerful Ruach HaKodesh. And he even suggested, this Rebbe, that mysteriously Esther Amalka asks for another day of destruction in Shushan. Why? Why was it so important that they should have another day of vengeance against their enemies in Shushan? They killed a total of another 500 people. Again, I don't know how many people lived in Shushan, how many were warring against the Jews, but it doesn't sound like that it was so historically significant. And of course, that led to a whole new holiday, Shushan Purim. Right? The only holiday where you have two different celebrations. Right, you have a Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios, but everyone celebrates the first day of Pesach together. Here we have, especially in Yerushalayim, Yizoche, many of you for the first time, to celebrate a different kind of Purim. Remember when I was in Grus, well, it's going to be strange here. Purim on a different day, but throughout the Shem, you'll see, Yerushalayim Purim is always wonderful. Of course, I'm sure many of you are taking advantage of two Purims. So, what does Esther say? Let's quote her words. Guess we'll have to end with this. So much more to say, but what does Esther say? Feel free to help me out. This is somewhere in Perek Tes. Or maybe Perek Tes. No, but I think it's Perek Tes. Yud Gimel, the last page. Vatomer Esther. Emal HaMelech Tov, Yinasein Gam Machor LaYudim Asher Rishushan LaSos Kedas Hayom VeTzaseres Bnei Amon Yislo LaEitz. Give us one more day. Said this Chassidus Sherebbe, this Esther Amalka with a great Ruach HaKodesh, looking into the future and seeing that, if you will, a spiritual descendant of Haman is going to try again. And unfortunately, he will be more successful than his spiritual ancestor. So she davens once again the dual meaning. Right, Vatomer Esther Imal Melech Tov, Melech Malchei Amlochim. Don't allow this decree to occur. And even though, of course, the decree did occur, at least partially, but Esther's tefillos were answered. Imal Melech Tov. There will be another day. There will be another day of destruction against the enemies of Israel, when they will be totally decimated. And of course, out of that Yeshua didn't come about, at least not yet, the Beis HaMikdash, but came about Medinas Yisrael. There's many, many ideas that have to be gone into very deeply in the Megillah, Again, everyone has their own way of learning it. I just saw recently, I did on the shelves here, first time, Rav Kook on the Megillah. I'm sure Rav Aviner must have a Sefer too on the Megillah. There's so much to study. If you keep in mind that theme that we began with, the hidden and the revealed, you'll see so much more in terms of appreciating the enormous miracles that HaKadosh Baruch Hu performed for us. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us, as the Bracha says, Bayamim Ahem Bazman Hazeh, not only the nace that occurred during that historical era, during this calendaric time, but also the miracles that Hashem has done for us in the past and that He continues to do for us in the future. Thank you.
Reminding everyone that